Would you like to... Could you tell me what communications with those directing the expedition were like? And did you feel you were given sufficient information when it was needed?
Yes, well, I think the main time that I was a bit worried about it was on our way out on the Highland Monarch. I remember that time after time, Ma would call us to an isolated spot on the boat deck when we expected to be told what we were going to do when we got down south, only to find that it was another lesson about not giving away any information to the other passengers on the ship. However, so far as Marr and I were concerned, he was quite communicative with me in London, and whenever I wished to ask him questions at the bases. But as the man through which all these messages went, I did feel that there were times when both Ma and later Andy Taylor felt that they weren't being kept up to date with what London was wanting us to do.
Mm-hmm. Can you remember if it was the Discovery Committee that would actually say what they wanted you to do, or was it... I think there was an Expedition Committee, actually.
Yes, well, of course, the Discovery Committee was all important, particularly where the scientific work of the expedition was concerned. And I think that, on the other hand, it might have been... I think all the messages probably went through the Falkland Island Governor's office. And they might have been dealt with at the London end by the Colonial Office.
Mm.
But I feel that there was some sort of lack of contact there that might have made things easier down south.
Mm-hmm. Are there any particular instances that you can call to mind?
No, I can't really remember, except one which was mentioned in some of the reports that I've read, and that was that the Hope Bay people, and Andy Taylor, who was then the leader, were never really told specifically when they were going to be relieved. That was the beginning of 1946.
Mm. Did you find at Base B you were kept informed? Were you told that the ship was coming down that second year?
Oh, in general, we would be... when the ship got near the bases, we'd be in communication with them by radio.
Yeah,
but before that, we wouldn't necessarily know that they'd left Stanley, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Sort of just thoughtless, really, that they didn't think... people at Stanley didn't think to let you know that they were coming.
It's just possible that with all that they had to do in Stanley and so on, they didn't realise that how important it was to us, living from day to day, as it were.
Mm. Did you find communication with the outside world was important to your lifestyle? Or?
Oh, yes. Mm. Particularly as more than half of the people on the expedition were married men.
Mm.
Therefore, it was important to hear fairly regularly about our wives and families and relations, particularly wives and families, who were in the very centre of things in Britain, bombing and doodlebugs and the like, whereas we were in perfect safety out in, barring accidents, out in the Antarctic.
Mm-hmm. Were your relations allowed to send telegraphic messages to you, or was it just mail coming in the normal way?
Yes, we after a certain period, which I think was May 1944, we were given the opportunity of sending one message a month or something like that, and I think our relations could do the same.
We spoke earlier about setting up the wireless stations at bases A and B. And in February 1945, the base D was established at Hope Bay. This was in much more difficult circumstances than the earlier bases were established, of course. And I wondered if you could tell me something about the establishment of the base, including the wireless operation.
Yes, well, of course, there was good reason why that should be more difficult, because in the first place it was a much more exposed base area and anchorage for the ships involved than it had been at Port LaCroix or Deception Island. The ice and icebergs coming out of the Weddell Sea were very liable to float on the currents into the bay, which the Eagle, which was being used at that time as the expedition's main ship, and which had come, was a Newfoundland sealer, was very unlike the Fitzroy, which had helped us with the establishments of Base B and Base A. Now, as I mentioned, whereas the Fitzroy had a very experienced crew of dealing with handling cargo and dealing with loading and unloading at places where there were no port facilities, HMS Eagle, their crew was a very experienced in their own way, but she was, after all, a sealer and was used to handling seal carcasses and so on. So that it so happened that when the Eagle came down to Hope Bay on that occasion, for a start, she had to manoeuvre the stores, the cases of stores in the hold and so on, at Deception Island. She'd also taken aboard a tremendous amount of extra building material, which was available there for the taking, and other things like 40-gallon oil drums and lots of that sort of bulky equipment on our deck. And in addition to having to moor herself in the cove, she was much further away from the site of the base. And most of her cargo had to be towed in a scow by a launch for something like over a mile to the beach near the base, and some of it was unloaded nearer on the ice near to the Yeah, to the ship. Mm.
This was to try and speed things up a little bit.
Yes. Mm. Now, because of the less experienced sailors, so far as this particular work was concerned, it took much longer to get the required equipment at the right time out of the ship.
Had they been able to load it in the same systematic way as earlier, so that you've got certain
I don't think, when it was transferred at Port Stanley, I don't think the same care was taken about having the B stuff in on the top of the cargo and the A stuff at the bottom.
Mm.
Therefore, there was the same problem, I think, with regard to the Eagle when she was coming down to Hope Bay. And probably, whereas in the year before, the Fitzroy had the building material and the wireless equipment and that sort of thing near the top of the hold. In particularly with regard to the wireless equipment, it was something like a week before we were able to get out even what was called a portable equipment, so that we could keep in touch with the Eagle from the base. And it was much longer than that before we got the wireless equipment, the main wireless equipment, out from the Eagle.
Mm.
Well, the other thing was that, of course, she experienced a lot of bad weather when she was in this position in near Hope Bay. And the next thing that delayed us was that Base B radio station went off the air, and neither Lather at Port La Croix nor the operator of the Eagle nor I could make any contact with them. And this happened towards the end of February, but while the Eagle was still unloading her first load, and it was then decided that after Taylor had talked to me, that I and Flett, who was Taylor's deputy, should go back with the Eagle as soon as she was empty to Deception to find out what had happened. And I agreed with Taylor that perhaps I, no matter what had happened, if it was, provided it was not that the base was burnt down or something like that, that I should take Donaghy's position at Deception, which appeared to be the weaker link in the radio side of things, and as I was the more experienced operator. Well, we decided to go to Deception, but on the first attempt a gale blew up, and when we tried to reach the Eagle in the motorboat, we ran into some ice, small bits of ice, which damaged the bow of the motorboat. And in fact, we had to shove sleeping bags into the hole to prevent the ship, the boat, from being filled with water.
Oh, gracious. I didn't realise it was as bad as that.
But we carried on, and eventually reached the Eagle. Wait a minute, I'm wrong here, you know. On the first occasion, we had to turn back. Because of this wind. We arrived back at Hope Bay, where most of the rest of the expedition were attempting to settle down in what was called Uncle Tom's Cabin, which Chippy Ashton had built from corrugated iron and timber from Deception Island, bearing in mind that we would have nowhere to sleep for a very long time, owing to the larger hut that they were putting up at Hope Bay, and the slow rate at which the stuff was coming ashore. And most of us slept in that Tom's cabin. It was rather a crush. Now, that was the one night. The next day, the gale subsided a bit, and it was then that we had the accident with the ice. Mm-hmm. But when we got... And we were very glad to get under the stern of the Eagle at anchor. The experienced crew of the Eagle saw that we each got a lifeline, and I can tell you we were jolly glad to scamper up the rope ladder and get aboard the old Eagle.
Mm. I can imagine. Mm. Presumably someone had to come over in the boat, in the launch, to take the launch back again as well. Is that so?
I think at that time, I'm not quite certain what happened there. You know, I'm getting on now a bit, and memory fails me. I was so glad to get aboard that I didn't care much what happened. To
it could sink then. So what happened when you reached?
When
Deception?
We reached Deception Island, of course, we found that the one of the generators which Tommy Donaghy was using in order to give some of the 12-volt batteries an initial charge had actually caught fire, which had ruined the generator and had caused some other incidental damage in the hut. Now, it's not quite certain how this happened, except that it could be, for instance, that one of the leads with the vibration of the motor came loose and possibly created a spark, which in turn ignited the oil on the generator. On the other hand, we had found that if you bring in the what was called white spirit petrol from the cold temperatures outside the hut, and if you filled the generator up near too near the top of the tank, because it was in the hot atmosphere of the hut, the petrol tended to expand and overflow. So that again, with the help of a spark, could have set the thing off. But it's the sort of unfortunate thing that could have happened to anybody, especially somebody who had not experienced very low temperatures.
Did Tommy Donaghy mind changing?
I don't really know. whether he minded, but I would think he was very disappointed at what happened, although, as I say, it could have happened to anybody. Mm. And probably well, the point was that whereas I had had some experience of the equipment and motor generators, and I'd also on occasion had to ask some of the other 8 members at the Port Lacroix to give me help with keeping the petrol motor going, it's just possible that if he needed that sort of help, he would get it out of the 12 or 13 members of the new base D, mm-hmm. the Hope Bay.
So it was a reflection of experience rather than
yes.
technical ability.
Yes.
Mm. And how did you feel about it? Because it's... was quite a change for you, wasn't it?
Well, I did agree with Taylor that it was the right thing for me to do.
Mm.
But I must admit that I was very disappointed at having to leave the centre of the main activity, which was going to be quite a lot at Hope Bay.
Mm.
And to leave the team of 8 other blokes that I'd been through and shared such a unique experience with up till then, and particularly at Port Lacroix, to go to a base where there were only 3 other people and where I expected it to be an uninteresting 10 months or a year, sitting in a hut, looking out at the uninteresting hills round about and the ash-ridden, snow-covered areas and an old ruined derelict factory with very, very little to do. But in fact, it turned out to be not like that at all. In the first place, I found it a challenging and interesting experience to spend that time alone on an island with just 3 other people. And I found that as the winter progressed, and with gales and lots of blizzards, the drab looking Deception Island became covered with snow, and all the old loose iron and corrugated iron and that was being knocked about in the winds of the summer came either frozen or weighted down with snow and were no longer creating a hazard in high winds by being blown about the old whaling station.
Mm.
So it was quite a scintillating and lovely sort of place, fairy-like place, in the winter. And the sea in the middle of Whalers Bay, the whole of Whalers Bay in the area, became a highway that we were able to travel on skis and get about the island.
Mm.
So that it was quite an interesting experience.
Did you travel very much?
Well, Rhys, who, of course, was a geologist, and also taking the Met observations, he organised laying 3 or 4 depots round strategic points on the inside circumference of the island, so that if anybody got blown away, either or was away on a journey and couldn't come back at night, or was blown away in a dinghy during the summertime, they would have somewhere a depot that they could approach, where they could get food and shelter.
Mm-hmm. So you all took part in laying those depots?
Well, Rhys and I did that.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Smith, of course, was a real Cockney, and the great thing that he did at Deception, and it was very important, he was the cook. And we looked after our cook, and we didn't he helped with the odd jobs outside, but cooking was his main duty, and we kept him to it. Then of course there was Sam Bonner. Sam Bonner was the eldest of the four of us. Rhys had asked for somebody to be sent down from Stanley to strengthen the team. He felt that three was too small a party to be left for the whole year at a base like that. And Sam Bonner was selected, and we felt that it was really unfair that a man of that age, who was not A1 in health, and to some extent had not the same attitude to what we were doing in the Antarctic, was ever allowed to come south.
Mm. How old was he when?
He was somewhere between 50 and 60.
Mm.
And he looked that.
Mm.
Now, we think it was unfair of them to send him down to the base, and it was unfair to allow him to come. Because, as it so happened, later on in the middle of winter, before the winter really set in, he had a heart attack. And Rhys was entirely dependent on wireless communication, and at that time it was Morse, with Doc Back at Hope Bay for advice and information as to how to treat Bonner. It was almost a continuous communication for some days, if not longer. But in the end, the leader, Taylor, asked for the Scoresby to pick Bonner up and take him back to Stanley, to the hospital in Stanley. Now, the Scoresby had set out from Stanley on her last trip of the season and was on her way down. But you can imagine our disappointment, not only for ourselves but for Bonner, when Marchese found that on entering the Bransfield Strait from the north, it was so full of ice that it was too dangerous to come on either to Deception or Hope Bay, and eventually he had to go back to Stanley. Now, that was serious for Bonner, and it was unfortunate because there was a new generator aboard, two new generators aboard, one for Deception Island to replace the one burnt out, and another to replace one at Port Roy, which they'd had trouble with. So Port Lacroix and Deception had to do with one generator for the whole of the winter season.
This was meant that you didn't have a backup if anything went wrong.
Exactly, yes. Mm. Luckily, nothing did go wrong.
Mm. It must have been very worrying with Bonner being so ill, though.
It was worrying particularly for Rhys and Doc.
Mm.
And the rest of us were sorry, of course, for Bonner.
Mm. If we could go back in time a little to the period when you just landed and decided that you would replace the Mickey, could you tell me from that point what happened?
Yes. Well, while the Eagle was loading her second cargo for Hope Bay, the Scoresby arrived at Deception. And after a short time, she left Deception, taking Donaghy and Flett back to Hope Bay. That was very roughly the end of the second week in March. Now, the Eagle at that time was loading her final cargo at Deception for Hope Bay, and this included things like 30 tons of coal, building material picked up at Deception, and other stores which were to be her last load for Hope Bay.
Had the Eagle actually brought these stores down from Stanley and then left some of them at Deception on an earlier trip? Is that how it works?
That was true of the main case stores and coal, but things like lumber and building material was Bugshy stuff that Chippy had indicated would be very useful to complete the building of extensions and so on, mm-hmm, to the main huts at Hope Bay.
Mm. So you were actually dismantling bits of the old whaling station?
That's
for
true.
That.
Mm. Mm. Well, then the Eagle left on her final trip to Hope Bay about 5 or 6 days later. And we settled down to our routine for the rest of the season, except for the arrival of any ships in the meantime.
Hmm.
Well, there was a period then of quite nasty gales and blizzards around about the middle of March, and one morning when I switched on at our usual morning schedule and contacted Donaghy, I learned that they were in real trouble at Deception.
At Hope Bay.
That's Hope Bay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the Eagle had apparently lost an anchor, had to put to sea because of the gales, had an accident with icebergs, had attempted to beach, had decided against it, and was then on her way towards Port Stanley with a broken bowsprit, damaged foredeck, and the Scoresby at Port Stanley had been asked to come to her assistance.
Mm-hmm. What was your reaction at deception to that news?
Well, of course, we were shattered at the idea that this should have happened to the Eagle, especially as she'd had to leave with quite a lot of the cargo that she'd taken in her last trip from Deception.
So that was material that wasn't landed at Hope Bay for the new
base?
That's
right. Mm-hmm. It included the coal and other things that were important. Now, I didn't take much action in that because Donaghy had the whole thing in hand, and I must admit, as I learned later on, that Donaghy had handled the communication problems connected with that accident in a fine way, and in his own mind it must have made up for any feelings he had had about changing from Deception to Hope Bay. However, in due course, about a week later, we learned that, with great relief, that the Eagle had made it to Port Stanley and had arrived safely.
Mm-hmm. So, back at Base B now, you settled into the winter routine, I suppose. Could you give me some idea of what that routine consisted of?
Yes, we, by this time, as I say, we were finding that Hope Bay, Deception rather, was a much nicer place than it looked like in the summer. But there were the four of us, and Alan Rees was an extremely nice chap, somewhat younger than I was. He was a geologist, but his main routine work at Deception was keep taking the meteorological readings three times a day and keeping a weekly observation on the state of the sea and the ice in Bransfield Strait outside Deception Island, which meant a walk of something like a couple of miles to a lookout point to the east of Neptune Bellows. And Neptune Bellows, as I think you have said to me in the past, is such a romantic name. All I can say, it lives up to it.
I suppose you got very familiar with it over the years.
Yes, indeed, having seen it for the first time in 1938.
Never thinking you were going to be wintering there.
Exactly. And it was like almost coming home to me in a way. But to get back to the weather reports, the actual equipment, outdoor equipment, was very roughly about 200 yards nearer the sea and away from any of either our building or any of the other old factory buildings. And particularly in bad weather, it was quite dangerous to make that journey for Reese. So we had arranged that if the weather was bad, he would do the journey and I would sit in what we called the Met Room. There were plenty of rooms in this big dormitory place at Deception. That I would sit at a desk taking down the information that he was collecting down at the Met station, as we arranged a telephone system between the office and the actual outside station. But in extreme cases, we would, at night, we would sometime on during the winter, we would use the oldest lamp which we had to enable him to, as a lighthouse for him to get back to base. But in extreme cases, we also used to use a lifeline so that if he went out, he could definitely get back. Otherwise, in the really bad weather, with visibility down to about 2 yards, and gale force winds, which were liable to blow you over, it would have been quite dangerous.
Presumably, if the weather was bad, the sea ice observations weren't taken.
No. If it was, but that would make, but he only did those once a week anyway. The other routine things with connected with the weather was, of course, that he did put up balloons to measure the direction of wind at very high altitudes, up to about 24,000 feet. It was then that I was able to help them with particularly on the telephone connection between the two points. Now, then there was the usual business of getting snow in to provide, or ice preferably, to provide water for the kitchen and cooking and washing and that sort of thing. So that took up quite a bit of time. Observations of sort of birds and things in the summer. And I suppose, too, you asked me how we kept ourselves interested. There seemed to be plenty to do. For pastimes, Reese and I played chess, and we played chess for part of the time over the radio with the other bases, using having one move at a time at the morning schedule, which was passed over by Morse. And we played cards. Charlie Smith and Bonner really enjoyed cards. We tried to teach Charlie Smith. Oh yes, they also played played draughts. Charlie Smith was a great draught player. And we tried to teach Charlie how to play chess, and we succeeded up to a point. We could never get him to realize that he wasn't playing draughts. So there was a lot of fun over that. We occasionally listened to gramophone records.
Was each base provided with a gramophone then? Up to an individual to
play? No, base had one of the old-fashioned portable gramophones and a selection of records which had been provided for us in London. I think they had been provided by some organisation like the Missions to Seamen's. And we also, of course, had a very good library at both bases.
Mm.
Not only of technical and scientific books, but of other more novels and that sort of thing, so again supplied by missions to Siemens, I think. We were lucky, of course, at Deception, that we each had a bedroom to ourselves. And apart from the fact that it was difficult to keep them warm, that was very nice, and we were able to spread ourselves. We also had a library, and we had the Met office, and we had the wireless office. And then there were a lot of empty rooms along the corridor, which we never used. But I must admit that most of our spare time indoors was spent in the rather large kitchen, which had a tremendous range in it, as well as slow combustion stoves, like the old pillar box type. But now, I haven't said anything about my friends on the Deception. There was Sam Bonner, who of course was older than any of us, and wasn't a fit man, and hadn't the interest in Antarctica that we had, particularly Reese and myself, and hadn't, of course, read anything about Antarctica. But he was a good, nice bloke, and there were times when we wondered whether he was as happy.